Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. If you've been enjoying the program, please consider a donation to help support the series. Your donation of any amount will make a real difference to us. You can donate online at any time via donate.pardesusa.org. Thank you very much. This week is the first Yahrzeit of Esther Bat Meir, Rabbi Meir Schweiger's mother. This podcast is dedicated to her memory. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Parshat Shemot. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Pardes Hashiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This Motzai Shabbat marks the first anniversary of my mother's departure. I would like to dedicate this podcast to her sacred memory, to my mother, Esther Bat Meir. This week's parsha is Parshat Shemot. I would like to examine the role of a number of women in our parsha, the role of those women who, in the words of our rabbis, were instrumental in bringing about the redemption from Egypt. There is a famous rabbinic saying which says, "Bizchut nashim tzidkaniyot nigalu Yisrael mi Mitzrayim." In the merit of the righteous women, the Jewish people were redeemed from Egypt. Let us begin with the first example that is clearly in the text. This is chapter 1. Verse 15. And the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, the name of one of them was Shifra, the name of the other, Pu'ah. And he said, when you give birth to the Hebrews, and you see on the birthing stool, if it is a boy, you should put him to death. And if it is a girl, you should keep her alive. And in verse 17, we're told, and the midwives feared God, the God. They did not do what the king of Egypt said to them. They kept the children alive. And then the king of Egypt calls the midwives and says to them, why have you done this thing? You have kept the children alive. And in verse 19, the midwives say to Pharaoh, because the Hebrews are not like the Egyptian women. They are chayot, which could be translated as they have vitality. Or it could be translated in a pejorative sense. They are like wild animals. Before the midwife comes to them, they have already given birth. And then we're told in verse 20 and 21, and God did well to the midwives, and the people multiply, and they become very powerful. Because the midwives feared God, God made for them homes. Let us begin by examining who are these midwives. The rabbis, the classic medieval commentaries, Rashi, Rashbam, Ramban, they are of the opinion that the midwives were Jewish. And in fact, the traditional rabbinic understanding is that the midwives were actually Moshe's mother and sister, Yocheved and Miriam. In our verses we're told, Shifra and Pu'ah. So the rabbis say, quoted by Rashi, why is she called Shifra? Shemeshaperet et havlad. She makes the baby more beautiful, fixes him up. Why Pu'ah? Because she soothes the baby. Bilashon pi'iya. She cries, but cries in a positive sense. when the baby is in distress. She sings to him. If in fact these midwives are Jewish, it perhaps is understandable that they would fear God and not collaborate with Pharaoh. On the other hand, it is a bit problematic. Why would Pharaoh turn to them? Yet it seems to be that this may be part of Pharaoh's demonic plan to pit Jews against Jews. And in fact, we see in chapter 5, again according to the rabbinic understanding, that there were policemen who were supervising the labor of the Jews, who were instructed to increase their workload. Who are these policemen? Jews. So that Pharaoh thought, this is a great way, divide and conquer. Pit Jew against Jew. And if it should be that the Jew is discovered killing the baby in childbirth, the hostility of the mothers will be vented against the midwives, not against Pharaoh. But Pharaoh's plan did not succeed. It did not succeed because the midwives feared God. There is a school of commentaries. Maybe I shouldn't say school. A number of commentaries. Beginning from the Second Temple period up to the modern time, who in fact say that these midwives were not Jewish, were Egyptian. And when it says the Hebrew midwives, in fact it means the midwives of the Hebrews, who in fact were Egyptian. And according to this perspective, Pharaoh turned to them because they're the natural ones who would cooperate with him, who would in fact jump on the opportunity to eliminate the Jews. And yet remarkably, they fear God. I mentioned in a previous podcast last year, this is the only time in chapter 1 where God's name is mentioned. And it may be highlighting the fact that these midwives are exceptional. In a world which doesn't recognize God, they fear God. But it's important to note that they not only believe in God, but they're prepared to act on that conviction, to act in a way which is the moral thing to do, to not simply take orders from the king. The midwives are women of conviction, but they are also wise. When they are called to Pharaoh, they know how to speak his language. They do not seek an overt confrontation. They sidestep it. They tell Pharaoh, you want to keep the secret, but what can we do? You know those Jewish women, they're like animals. Before we even come, they've already given birth. And if we were to then do anything, it would all come out in the open. What can Pharaoh say to that? Interestingly, when these people defy Pharaoh, Pharaoh backs down. He does not put them to death. But what's even more striking is that we're told that God reinforces their efforts. In verse 20, because of what they did, God sees to it that the Jewish people multiply, that they become more powerful. And as I mentioned a moment ago, if in fact these midwives are Egyptians, this becomes a deafening condemnation of all the other Egyptians that collaborated with Pharaoh. These midwives who have no power base, simple women, are able to stand up for what they believe in. In fact, there's a rabbinic comment which says that when it says the midwives did not listen to Pharaoh and they keep the children alive, what is added by saying they kept the children alive? And the rabbis say, not only did they not put the children to death, the boys to death, but they actively nourished them. to enable them to grow up and be strong. Here we have a model of women who have conviction, who have strong personalities, which enable them not to be overwhelmed by the king, who are prepared to stand up but defy him in a way which is smart, to be able to outmaneuver him in his own game. And in the end, they are rewarded by God. We have a similar idea, which is expressed in a midrash, Midrash Tanchuma, on Parshat Pkudei, later on in Shemot, when it talks of the construction of the tabernacle, and it speaks of the kior, the laver, where the priests would wash their hands. Chapter 38, verse 8. It says that it was made out of the mirrors of the multitude of women. And the Midrash addresses the question, who are these multitude of women? What was so special about the mirrors that they were accepted to be used for the construction of the laver? And the Midrash goes on to say, when the Jews were engaged in harsh labor in the beginning of our parsha, in chapter 1, verse 13 and 14, where it says the Egyptians worked the Jews harshly. They made their lives bitter in all of their harsh work. So the rabbis say, when they were in the midst of that, Pharaoh decreed upon them that they should not sleep in their homes. They should not have normal marital lives, engage in sexual relations. And Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta said, what did the Jewish women do? They would go down to the Nile, draw water, and God would bring about that they would get small fish in their pitchers. And then what they would do is they would sell some of the fish, they would cook some of the other ones, they would take with them wine, go out to the fields, and feed their husbands. And after they had finished eating and drinking, the women would take the mirrors and begin playing with their husbands. And she would say, I am prettier than you, and egg him on. And then he would say, no, I am prettier than you. And this play, this game, would arouse their sexual desire and bring about the multiplication of the Jewish people, which God reinforced. And hence, in chapter 1, verse 12, when it says, and when the Egyptians would afflict and persecute the Jews, as much as they would afflict them, so would they increase, so would they burst forth. The verse doesn't make any sense. The more the Egyptians afflict the Jews, the more the Jews should be decimated. And yet it seems to boomerang. Clearly, this may be a covert way of saying, God will not let this happen. God is not going to allow the Egyptians to destroy the Jews. And even though God is not mentioned explicitly in the verse, God is the one who is preventing this from happening. But according to our Midrash, God is doing that in response to the actions of people, reinforcing the actions of those Jewish women. Those Jewish women who would not succumb to Pharaoh's decree, who took a stand, but once again took a stand not in direct confrontation of Pharaoh, but sidestepping Pharaoh. If Pharaoh will not let the men come to their homes, will not let the men have relations with their wives, the women will go out into the fields where nobody's looking, find a spot, on the one hand right under his nose, but on the other hand doing something which he never could have imagined in his wildest dreams. Once again beating Pharaoh at his own game. And once again having God reinforce their actions. And then we find the third story. In the beginning of chapter 2, Vayelech ish mi beit Levi, vayikach et bat Levi. And a man went from the house of Levi and took a daughter of Levi. And the rabbis in the Gemara, in Masechet Sota, are troubled. What is this verse coming to teach me? What does it mean to say he went? Where did he come from? Where is he going to? And then the rabbis bring up a very interesting story. Rav Yehuda Bar Zvina said, this man is following the advice of his daughter. And then this is elaborated on in a Braita, which says, Amram, the father of Moshe, was a leading figure in his generation. When the evil Pharaoh decreed that all the boys should be thrown into the Nile, Amram said, we are toiling for naught. What's the point of staying married? According to this midrash, which would seem to be clear from the text, Amram is already married and has children before Moshe is born. It is clear from our section, chapter 2, that Moshe has an older sister. We know later on, from chapter 6, even before that, he has an older brother. 3 years older, in fact. Yet they are not mentioned, their births are not mentioned in our section. And this rabbinic comment says that after Miriam and Aaron were born, Pharaoh decreed that all the boys should be thrown in the Nile. And Amram's response is to divorce his wife. His response is one of despair. What point is there in bringing more children into this world when they'll be put to their death? And the Midrash goes on to say, based on his precedent, the Jews follow suit. Everyone then went and divorced their wives. And then Amram's daughter comes to him, Miriam, and she says, Father, your decree is worse than Pharaoh's. Pharaoh decreed only on the males. You decreed also on the females. Pharaoh's decree is relevant only in this world. Your decree is relevant also in the world to come. You're depriving people of a share in the world to come. Pharaoh's decree is doubtful whether in the end it will succeed. But you who are a righteous person, God will uphold your decree. Miriam is castigating her father, openly defying her father's action. It is not like the examples we had before of the midwives or of the women and their husbands who are subtly, deceptively defying Pharaoh. Here is Miriam, who is outwardly defying her father. You're worse than Pharaoh. And in the end, he listens to her advice. He retakes her mother, which brings about the birth of Moshe. But it doesn't end there. Miriam prophesies that this child that will be born will be the savior of the Jewish people. And lo and behold, we're told in our verse that the baby is born and they see that he's good. And in the Talmud it says that when the baby is born, the house lit up. And the family sees this as a corroboration of the prophecy This is somehow a special child, a miracle child. And then they hide them for 3 months. It is interesting that in our verses in the Chumash, Amram is only mentioned in verse 1. From that point on, we're told of Moshe's mother and sister. No longer a word about his father. And perhaps this is the basis of why the Midrash says that all of a sudden, when it seems the baby Moshe is discovered, and when there is the need to somehow get him out of the house, Amram once again throws up his hands in despair. And he says, in fact, according to the Midrash, he smacks his daughter and says, "Now let's see what will happen with your prophecy." But she is persistent. Moshe's mother makes a little boat, a little basket that she puts him in. And they put him by the water. And his sister stands there, looking to see what will be. And according to some commentaries, Second Temple period, they are actually involved, day in, day out, feeding him, guarding him. It's not immediate that Pharaoh's daughter comes to the water. And when Pharaoh's daughter finally comes and sees the baby and says, "This is a Jewish baby," Miriam, Moshe's sister, is there and immediately says, "Would you like me to get a Hebrew woman to nurse him?" And thereby she preserves the connection between Moshe and his mother for that whole period of nursing. Here is an example. Moshe's sister, Moshe's mother, and I'd like to highlight Moshe's sister, who is not prepared to succumb to the overwhelming circumstances around her, but wants to defy them, who pushes her father to do so, who has this faith in the future of the Jewish people and does not want to allow her father to be overwhelmed by the reality. But it is not just, "I believe. I will act on my belief. I will do everything I can, put my life on the line to make this vision a reality." And the last figure that we have, Pharaoh's daughter. Pharaoh's daughter, according to the Midrash, comes down to the river to cleanse herself of idolatry. Perhaps I would explain this a little bit differently and say, Pharaoh's daughter is going down to the river to see for her own eyes what is happening there. It is her moment of truth. Can she live with what her father is doing, with the destruction of these Jewish babies? And when she hears that baby, and she knows that it's Jewish, and I won't go into how she knows, she saves him. Not, as it says, by the midwives, because she fears God. She saves him because she has compassion. Very interestingly, Pharaoh, later on we see, does not fear God. Pharaoh says again and again, "I do not know God." But perhaps even worse, Pharaoh has a heart of stone. No compassion. And this is why the rabbis say that this is the moment when Pharaoh's daughter undergoes a transformation, where she is no longer the daughter of Pharaoh, but she is the daughter of God. She defies her father. Eventually, she raises this child as her own, brings him in the palace, names him, and it is very significant that the name that she gives him is the name that we know him by. And the significance of his name, Moshe, the one who was drawn from the water, the one who was saved from death. Moshe, whose very existence becomes a symbol for his future destiny. He is the one who is drawn from the water, who is taken out of the water and given a new lease on life. He is the one who needs to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, give them a new lease on life. There is another figure who appears in our parsha, who is also very significant, but I will leave that for another podcast. And that is Tzipporah, the wife of Moshe. Let me summarize. What is it that characterized these women that I have just been discussing? What seems to make them so special are their qualities, their conviction, fear of God, their faith in the future of the Jewish people, their compassion, as we see by Pharaoh's daughter, their preoccupation with life in the midst of death, their ability to take a stand, to be strong, and to find smart ways to be able to take their conviction and make them a reality. They fight Pharaoh, not with weapons, not with plagues. They fight Pharaoh with a determination to affirm life. Not only do they stop death, but they actively nourish life. Pharaoh's daughter not only takes Moshe out of the river, but she sees to it that he needs to be nursed. This is what makes these women so special. With your permission, I would like to take a minute to talk about my mother. My mother lived to be 94 years old. The last 34 years of her life she spent in Israel. The last 8 years of her life she spent literally living in my house with my family. There was a very interesting closure of a circle. My mother was a Holocaust survivor who spent a year in Polish forests wearing a short sleeve dress, eating berries, somehow surviving in a way which is mind-boggling. She knew that her family was totally destroyed as it was happening. She had a grandmother who was 93 years old, who was very sharp, who, as she was going to be taken to her death, said to my mother, "Run away. Don't stay with me. You still have a life to live." It was a very, very difficult decision for my mother to make. But her wise grandmother reflected this profound idea of how we are a religion preoccupied with life, determined to carve out our future. And my mother followed her lead. My mother became the continuity of her grandmother. Not only did she survive the Holocaust, she eventually made Aliyah, was able to merit to have 9 grandchildren, 7 great-grandchildren. I am an only child. My mother wanted very badly to continue the next generation. I am an only child because she was unable to have more children, which was very, very painful to her. And as I said, God rewarded her actions, and she was able to not only produce grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but to actually see them, live with them, inspire them. My mother was a very strong woman, but very gentle. A very wise woman, very subtle. She knew how to get things that she wanted, but in a wise way. She never looked to promote her own needs. She was preoccupied with others. But her success in furthering others is ultimately the greatest testament to who she is. She was part of that chain of righteous women in whose merit we are redeemed. The women who are involved in day-to-day survival, who have a vision of continuity, who do not allow themselves to be overwhelmed by circumstances, but affirm life, further life. May she be an advocate for the Jewish people and be an inspiration to us all of our vision of the future. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always important to us. Please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks very much, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.